And that was, who was that again?
Mercury Rev.
Mercury Rev with?
Car Wash Hair.
Car Wash Hair. That's going to close out Ear Buddies for the day. And that was the hair the hair show, right? Sort of?
All
the all hair songs. Wow, that is impressive. I wish we could be so true to the playlist or whatever, to the theme. But we're going to jump around a little bit as we want to do with, I don't know, is that yours?
No.
Okay, sorry. This is Socialist Alternative Radio. Mix it up a little bit here now with talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective for the next 2 hours. We're here every other week doing our thing. And this week, I'll be your host, no co-host this week. Diego is visiting relatives in another place, and so will not be on the show. Including a place where he can't call in, I think. But anyway, I will be your host today. My name is Jeff, and I've got a little paperwork to do here, so I might throw on a song early on. But let me give you a taste of what the show is going to be about today. Millennials are screwed. Now, that might not be a, you know, surprise. The next recession will destroy millennials, quote unquote. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into it's been a tough week for the working class from my personal perspective. And we're going to get into the Shama Sawant campaign, KSHAMAWSAWANT, as an example of there are independent socialists out there running in the off-year elections happening around the country and also in 2020, believe it or not. And we are also going to talk about, let me see, I'm going through, you hear me shifting papers around this. I actually had in mind what we're going to go through, but let me just make sure I'm getting it right. Yeah, we'll get into the Democratic Party a little more like we often do, why that's not a way forward for working people, neither Republicans, obviously. Get into a little bit about the immigrant rights movement, some good organizing going on around the country against ICE, against the wall, and all that repressive stuff that, by the way, is going to hurt you. What goes around comes around, to put it really, really simply, not very political in that sense. But in this, but I can connect the dots, and I will, if we have time for that. But basically, just a foreshadowing what happens with if you give all powers to ICE, and the government starts to run with immigrant rights and the corporations as they already have, with a way to get at the working class in general. Now, what I mean by that is that the corporations will exploit immigrant labor to the T as much as they can, paying substandard wages, having horrible benefits, and using the threat of deportation, the threat of exposure as being quote unquote illegal, which is nobody's illegal really, and all workers from other countries, they're our sisters and brothers, and we should not be singling them out for bad treatment, because that will happen to us. We should be trying to organize with them, like many of us do. And yet you see the, whether it's Democrats in power, Republicans, you see the creation of ICE, the use of the mass deportations, and the use of that threat to make the exploitation of immigrant labor even more threatening, even more you know, under the table in many cases, to the point where there's been documented instances of outright slavery, believe it or not, in the United States, focusing a lot on, of course, you know, undocumented people, undocumented workers. And there was recently this high profile ICE raid of a chicken processing plant in the South. And a lot of the chicken processing plants, I would say, are probably wall to wall immigrant labor at this point. And again, you know, if you have people that say, which the corporate media likes to repeat, which the farmers love to repeat, right? The big farmers, or even the small farmers in some cases. You know, the non-immigrants, the white Americans, the Native American, whatever, you know, whatever term they come up with, they just won't do this work, you know? Well, the immigrants are doing, the immigrant labor you're exploiting, many of them won't do that work either. They get other jobs, right? Those that are, settle down for these, settle for these horribly exploitative labors because they're desperate, because they have to. And you won't look at another type of worker, that's the wrong phrase to use, another ethnic background for a worker or you won't look for documented workers, quote unquote, because you know you can't have that extra threat of deportation hanging over them. And that's what, and also many times language, language skills that are, you could say that the bosses don't like that sometimes they can't communicate with the workers in English, but the reality is they'll always find a way to do that, but use the language barrier if it exists, and it does in many cases because of lack of education, to confuse workers with paperwork and laws that really don't exist and that kind of thing. And so there's a lot of things conspiring against immigrants that are desperately trying to find work, send money back to their countries where their families are poor or just struggling, like a lot of families here, because of policies that the United States has implemented. Like right now, NAFTA just saw new NAFTA. It's not being called NAFTA, but there's a new trade agreement just shot through Congress. The Democrats didn't put up a fight at all against it. They liked it. A lot of them voted for it. It sailed through. But really, you can trace mass migration from, let's say, Mexico to the United States based on what NAFTA did way back in the 90s to the average Mexican farmer, and then by extension, other types, even manufacturing. It just basically dropped trade barriers. So things that you can produce cheaper in the United States, like food, ironically using cheap labor, which had already started, but it increased drastically after NAFTA because farmers that couldn't make it in Mexico were forced to migrate to the United States to try to make a living, send money back, and so on. It made the problem much bigger, quote unquote. Now, this is a problem. Migration's a problem under capitalism. Not the migrant's fault, not the worker's fault that has to move. Many of us, of course, in America, as you've heard this argument before, but it's a very valid argument, come from people that had to move at a certain point. Part of my family, half of my family, over half, depending on how you define your family, had to move from countries where they couldn't survive. Or they couldn't survive well enough and had to move here. And by the way, didn't have the so-called American dream kick in. Had to still struggle and barely, and in many cases, paid with their lives for coming over here. But died early, from overwork and exhaustion and bad medical care and all the rest of it that you get here in the United States. But whether your family traces its roots to last year or back to the 1700s or 1600s, and maybe you were brought over through forced means, through slavery or indentured servitude, or you were come from criminals that were thrown on a boat and said, yeah, you're going to America, or whatever they called it then. And whether you're Native Americans forced off your land. I mean, there's a common heritage, unfortunately, of suffering and exploitation, and that is what first the sort of feudal slave society that existed here and then the transition to capitalism has brought, and that hasn't gone away despite the enormous wealth that exists, that we've built that wealth, working people and the massive technologies and so on. But getting back to the point about immigrant labor, that immigrant labor is our labor. It's the labor of working people, and everyone can trace back to immigrants or migrants or people that moved. The whole history of humanity is actually migration and movement. Whether you go back to native peoples, they still came from somewhere and they moved around places. That's supposed to be part of human nature in a real way. Human nature changes, of course, but part of a sort of essential, part of a human nature that has not changed that much, let's put it that way, is the tendency to migrate, to move to places where hopefully, just to avoid, go back way, way back, to avoid predators, or to, this place is safer than another place, or to, under the complexities of capitalism, find a decent life, or a life that's severely unequal, but at least survivable for a time, I mean, we definitely have people fleeing countries in Central America based on dictatorships and out of control militaries and right wing policies the United States supported and still supports, and people need to escape now the chaos that the chaos and the violence that ensues. Or in Mexico, it's partially that, but also the something like the NAFTA agreement and other trade agreements that create a cheap pool of labor in Mexico for to be exploited within Mexico itself, but also be exploited when it has to when people have to migrate here, and that's incredibly unfair. And of course, unions are organizing a lot of a certain amount of, I won't say a lot, but a certain amount of workers still, including immigrant workers. And my experience, direct experience in the labor movement, is a lot of the immigrant workers coming from countries with more of a socialist movement, they're the best union fighters. They're the best union people, you know, and in terms of understanding what's going on. And for anyone in the United States, any so-called American worker or native worker that looks down on immigrants, that thinks immigrants are a problem for them as a worker, you got it absolutely bass-ackwards wrong, man. The immigrant workers are going to be the best fighters, the best brothers and sisters in the class struggle and in the labor movement, and you need to know that. You need to understand that. You need to learn that. I didn't have to learn that personally because I come from immigrants, you know, mostly. I mean, there was one side of my family that's been here since the mid-1800s in the North, but they had it so crappy that I don't know what you call them. They were immigrants, but it just never took. The whole farming thing never took, and they were itinerant laborers, railroad workers. Like, I don't mean like engineers or something. I mean like shoveling snow off railroad tracks and being laborers on the railroad tracks. Itinerant carpenters. I found out about 10 years ago that one of my relatives was on relief, as they call it, in the 30s. That was the early word for, benefits, state benefits, welfare benefits. They spent many years on relief. Then there was those that tried to make small farming go, couldn't make it go. They went into the cities nearby and worked in factories. In my case, General Electric up in Schenectady and other factories. I had a grandfather who I never knew, died fairly young, working in a factory in Ballston Spa many years ago as the, I don't know what to call it, it was non-union, unfortunately, and it was he was in charge of making sure that the power for the factory kept going. I don't know if he was in charge, actually. That was his job, actually. I never heard if he was in charge or not, which included just throwing coal into a big furnace and gathering coal and doing all sorts of rotten things and for little money. And he died of a burst appendix at work. So something went wrong there with health, with getting him to the care. Maybe he ignored the symptoms or something. But in any case, it was also the savage difficulty of the work, the hard nature of the work. If you've ever done any, I'm doing a slight digression here. If you've ever done any hard physical labor, and I've done it, I've worked in factories. I tried my hand at some little bits, not for money, but for helping people out, construction, and I'm bad at that stuff, and that's so hard. But factory work, driving, delivery, warehouse stuff, all kinds of stuff that can be really hard. And then now we have people working into their 70s here in the U.S., no hope of retiring. And if you try to work hard physical labor like that, and by the way, the robots are not about to take that stuff over. Don't believe what you hear. There's so much of it. That you worked, people think, I don't know, what do people think? I mean, people think that there's a lot of people that now work in jobs that don't require hard physical labor. They're doing something related to computers or something like that. I mean, what do they think about, retiring when you're 50 or 60 from doing hard physical labor in construction or in a factory or something? No, you can't last, their body can't last that long. Your body can't last that long. In some cases, your mind can't last that long because the bosses or the corporations are always trying to make the work as simplified as possible so they have as little training as possible to exploit your labor power and your labor time. So anyway, throw immigrant workers into the mix, migrant workers, our brothers and sisters that have to have to chase the money just like we do. And there have been times where Americans, people that were settled in America, went to other countries in big numbers to try to survive during the Depression was one example in the United States. You had actually American workers going to Russia, for example, in the 1930s, believe it or not. I've actually met some of them and some of their relatives who had to try to survive. They ended up surviving in Russia. And at that time, and that's not a plug for Stalinism, right? We don't support Stalinism. which is what the Russian Revolution turned into under Stalin when the Stalinists took over. But they're just trying to give an example that there will be times, even in the United States, where migration is not completely internal, where you're not moving from one state to another, which is the equivalent of moving from one country to another in some geographic areas, like in Europe or whatever, chasing money, chasing work, trying to sell your labor because you're not surviving well, or you can't survive at all in certain places. And pretty soon that migration could easily, in the United States, take the form of trying to go to other places. And again, the profound political thought we started with, what goes around comes around, it becomes very literal. And you want to be treated like an immigrant is treated here. You don't want to be treated like that. You don't want to be treated like that. So, for example, this law, this thing they're debating, I don't think it's come to a vote yet. Maybe I'm wrong. On driver's license for immigrants. Man, we were in Social Alternative. We were organizing for that back in the 80s in Austin, back in the 90s. In Austin, you know, with among Brazilian immigrants and Latino immigrants and other places in Boston and East Boston and so on. It should have happened back then. Why would you deprive anyone the right to drive a car based on what the government, controlled by big corporations, says about who they are and what they are? Oh, you're illegal, stamp. Boom. You got the illegal stamp on. Might as well put a scarlet letter A, or might as well brand them. Might as well put a concentration camp number on them. I know all those things aren't equal. The suffering is different, but it's still the same mentality that you're going to take a human being, you're going to categorize them and make them unhuman, make them not be human in your eyes, in the eyes of others, so you can exploit them, right? As you know, like humans are exploited under capitalism, or for most people under capitalism, so you can exploit them to get yourself richer, you know. No, that doesn't work. It doesn't work for socialists. That doesn't really work for working people in general. We have to be as united as possible, or they're going to divide and conquer us, which happens every day all over the place, you know? Anyway, so back to the, we're going to get into that hopefully later. I promised I'd throw some music on real quick because I got to do a technical thing here. And you're listening, if you just turned into Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class, democratic, socialist perspective, we just had a little riff on why immigrants are not your enemy. They are your, if you're a worker, they're your sisters and your brothers and your comrades if they're active in the socialist movement. And so we're going to jump into this. This song I actually played a little while ago, last month, I think, by Roy. I got this thing from the station here. By the way, you're listening to WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO Medford. Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, 91.5 FM. WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio, Tufts Educational Radio. We got a lot of nice names. And I found this in the station, you know, came in May. We got Rye Cooter, great picture of him on the back, and a lot of good songs. And I'm going to throw on here Jesus and Woody, do my little paperwork and come right back at you. So Jesus and Woody by Rye Cooter. Your land.
bound to lose. You were a dreamer, Mr. Guthrie, and I was a dreamer too. Once I spoke of a love for those who hate. It requires effort and strain. Vengeance cast a false shadow of justice, which leads to destruction and pain. Say I was a friend to sinners, but by now you know it's true. Guess I like sinners better than fascists, and I guess that makes me a dreamer too.
Cooter with Jesus and Woody from his album called The Prodigal Son, which I misspelled, P-R-O-D-I-G-A-L, if you're following along online. By the way, if you want to listen to this show and others, you can go to WMFO.org, listen live streaming, or to the last show. If it's on the archive, go to schedules, click on the show, and there should be at least one show on there. For the show you're looking for, and you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio right now. We have many different programs. We call ourselves Freeform here at WMFO because that means the shows can be of many different natures, many different formats of music or talk and music. And we are of that talk and music hybrid. And boy, that was a beautiful song, Rod Cooter. I used to listen to him and this you know, dates me, which is fine. I'm not ashamed of surviving. Kind of proud of it in some ways. Yeah, this goes back to the 80s for me, right? You listen to Ry Cooder. I used to listen to Ry Cooder. I used to play him on a radio show, two radio shows I had when I went to college. What was the call numbers of that station? I don't remember. Oh, well. I had a folk show and I had a punk show, which might sound completely separate, but as you know, some of you know, they're not, and there's some crossover there. And on the folk show, got into bluegrass, knew some people playing some serious bluegrass music, and got tuned into Ry Cooder and others at the time. So yeah, there you have it, some Ry Cooder music as we filled out some paperwork here. We are now going to get into what we promised earlier, some information that might not sound, you know, okay, so we do stuff on this show, Socialist Alternative Radio. We talk about socialism. We want you to become a socialist. We want you to become a revolutionary socialist. We want you to see that capitalism is not only threatening to destroy the planet, at least in terms of being fit for human habitation. There'll still be some rocks here and some, you know, roaches running around, I guess. But in various ways, capitalism can do it just by its production of, you know, through competition and through not having any sort of democratic planning and always needing to expand, not based just on greed of a few. That's part of it, but it's mostly the system itself. To survive as a capitalist, you must always be expanding, or some other capitalist will take you over, or you'll reach a point where your costs are, as far as profit mongering, your costs are, quote, too high, unquote. Capitalists always want to increase their profit margins at all costs. And the short-term maximization of profit is the god of capitalism. So that creates chaos and destruction. I guess there's some pro-capitalist philosopher that I have never read directly much of that talked about creative destruction under capitalism or creative chaos under capitalism. And okay, buddy, you're dead now, but probably come back and see how wonderful the creative destruction is. And by the way, creative, I put in huge quotes, huge rabbit ear quotes, because what's so creative about finding a million different ways to privatize something and create a fee for it? And speaking from direct experience, I just went through the hell of having someone get sick that I know. I'm not going to, you know, out the person because they might want their privacy, but someone very close to me just got sick. I had to take this person to the emergency room. Ka-ching, $100. Even though I'm in a union, even though I pay hundreds of dollars every month in my paycheck, I never see the money. It just goes to the health insurance company's profits. And as a family, I have a wife and children, partner and children, and we don't use healthcare that much, but every once in a while something happens to someone that we know or in our family that we have to deal with like anybody else. And our union leadership sold us out on healthcare, keeps increasing I work for Harvard University. This Harvard University has more money than any university in the world, more money than many corporations. It's got an endowment now hitting, what, $42 billion or something like that. It's got income coming in that nobody actually studies, except I have a little bit and some other people, that has nothing to do with their endowment, but streams of income coming in that they could spend on whatever they want. The endowment, they talk about it being earmarked. You can only spend it for certain things. Not true. There's a lot of unrestricted endowment money at Harvard. They run it like a business. It's run as a business, and it's there to train elements of the ruling class in various disciplines, like how to defend capitalism in a thousand different ways, as a judge perhaps, or as a politician, or as a venture capitalist. What is it? 38% of Harvard grads, or 48% or something? I think it's 38% in a recent study, are going right directly into financial capital, you know, speculating on money and making big bucks doing that. That's very productive. Thank you so much, by the way, Harvard graduates, those of you that choose that noble path of self-enrichment and environmental destruction and the exploitation of labor to the death in many cases. So God forbid, but it happened. We had to bring somebody to the, I had to bring someone to the emergency room, ka-ching, $100, even though I'm in a union. They gave the 10 years ago, five years ago, maybe. That would have been free. Not free, of course. I'm paying for it every month, but it would have been part covered by insurance. It's like the thing we talk about on the show often. Remember Michael Moore's film, Sicko, from the, whenever that was, right? Not too long ago, or maybe a while ago, anyway. Or you've read articles about how people that have insurance, that's just one little baby step in the stairway to hell, down to hell of capitalist healthcare, right? So you can have insurance, but have a lot of things the insurance doesn't cover, and you're still paying big bucks into the insurance. Why this is legal, why the insurance company bosses are not in prison, it's because capitalism. It's because this is a system rigged completely for the rich, the super rich, the big corporations. If you don't know that, there's something wrong with you on a fundamental level. Now, if you don't know the solution to that, if you don't know all the details, don't blame you at all. We're not taught that stuff. We're taught to love it. We're taught to say, I think this is the greatest country in the world and greatest economic system in the world, blah, 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 blah. You know, well, I don't blame people for having illusions that because they haven't, the educational system, everything is weighing against learning how it's not true, right? But that this is the greatest, that this is an economic system that helps working people in any way. Even people that make it, right? Even people that manage to get a good job at the higher end of the working class. It's so precarious. And one of the things that makes it precarious is healthcare, by the way. I think it's first or second in bankruptcies is bankruptcy from healthcare. And then they look at further into it, the people that are researching that, and it turns out it's people with health insurance, but the health insurance didn't cover what it should have, what's needed. So, boom, I owe $100 or $150, I think it is, because I had to bring someone to the emergency room. Then, boom, they had to have a CT scan, $50. Both of those things were covered by insurance 10 years ago. What's changed? Nothing's changed except they changed the rules and the unionship sold out and gave it to the this mega corporation that doesn't need the extra money, right? And even a corporation, there's no such thing as corporation needing money, right? If a corporation says, oh, hey, we're not making enough profit, say, screw you. This thing you're making, maybe we need that. Take it under public ownership. Public ownership. That's the answer. Not go out of business and throw everyone on the street and people can't get the thing they might need, right? Look at this Triple E stuff here in Massachusetts. By the way, we do have international listeners and I'm going kind of local here. So say here in Eastern Massachusetts in the United States, there's an outbreak of a mosquito-borne disease called Eastern Equine Encephalitis, Triple E for short. And there's a lot of the news about it, the corporate media talking about it. 7 people have contracted it. Some of them have died from it, I believe. So I'm sitting there listening to all these reports and I'm saying, you know, as a Marxist, as a socialist, I know why there's no cure for Triple E. I just know, even though I've never studied it directly. There's no cure for Triple E because under capitalism, there has to be a market for something for them to make money off it. There has to be, in other words, enough people dying. I don't know what the critical mass is for capitalism, right? of death. It could be millions in some situations, or it could be 20 rich people in another situation before they'll invest their precious profits and ill-gotten gains sitting in banks to find a cure for something like that. And finally, a doctor said, not in the angry social justice words that he needed to say it, but a doctor said, well, they don't, there aren't enough people suffering from Triple E to have their, I don't know how he, I remember how he phrased it. He didn't use the word corporations or capitalism or anything, words, but he said the equivalent of, there's not enough people dying from it or contracting it to get anyone to invest in trying to find a cure, which is probably pretty easy, actually, relatively speaking. Mosquito-borne disease, they're finding cures for those or mitigating medications all over the world. But here under capitalism, where especially a capitalism where, but not especially, I mean, it's true anywhere there's capitalism, but you know, there were times under capitalism in the United States where some, like the cure for polio was found, right? And famously, like I get this thing on Facebook sometimes where people, scientists from like the 40s and 30s and 50s, when they were part of curing disease, they would immediately, they wouldn't try to personally profit from it. They would, the government would be the, would be the, they let the government have the patent, and it would be produced by the government, you know, the cures and so on. The vaccine, sorry, I'm spacing on the word there. The vaccine. So, you know, they wouldn't even think something like Jonas Salk, they wouldn't even think of kind of trying to personally own that stuff or set up a corporation to exploit that stuff. Now, that's all that's going on behind the scenes, let me tell you, in research, is how soon can I take this and set up a corporation around it and make billions of dollars off of drugs that people need, right? How soon can I do that? How can I do it without being accused of patent infringement? How can I do it without being accused of illegally taking knowledge from, I've signed this agreement with some big corporation, I won't use anything I do here. How can I go and do this, or how can the corporation itself do this on its own? There's all this, like, this huge industry of trying to prove that only one person or one corporation came up with something. And really, in science, it's collective. It's always collective. Edison gets credit for inventing something. You can bet there were 3 other, 10 other people or corporations or groups or governments working on that stuff. No, whenever you hear a so-and-so invented such-and-such, it's a lie. So-and-so had to learn, right? Let's go back to their infancy. Someone had to teach them how to read, right? Someone had to teach them how to wipe their butts. Someone had to teach them how to survive as a human, right? So they then learn certain things. And that goes into, that continues into adulthood. They're reading a journal that someone wrote an article in, and they didn't have the capital under capitalism to create a cure. So they're going to use that journal information to create a cure because they're going to get some rich person to back them, you know? And then they're going to get the name, I discovered this. No, you didn't discover it. It was science that discovered it. Even under capitalism, a very distorted, kept down, I'm trying to avoid nasty words on the radio, a distorted, infantile science. You know, everyone says, oh, the technology in the U.S. and all that. No, this is nothing. This is nothing compared to what technology could be in a planned economy. And a democratically planned economy is what socialism is all about. A democratically planned economy, not only can you come up with technology that would make the stuff we're working with look like child's play, but in addition, we could make it so it doesn't hurt us. It doesn't hurt the environment. Build it, build technology, use technology, and dispose of technology in a sustainable way, which is not at all happening now. Plastic oceans, check it out. Plastic in the oceans, I mean, if you don't believe me. Also, just the knowledge that would get spread under a socialist a socialist economy worldwide, where you wouldn't have to worry about profit to get out information. Oh, the corporate media does things for profit, puts out information for profit, you know? Imagine a information gathering, which is what media is basically, but not based on the profit mongering of a few rich people that want to control that information to defend their system, to have it for themselves, etc. Then you have people making more informed decisions in a media that's free for everybody, free to everybody. You have the average person will sound like an Einstein in the future if we achieve democratic socialism or whatever name you want to put on it, a democratically planned economy. If we achieve that in the future, and people have written about this, Marx has written about this, Leon Trotsky wrote about this, others wrote about this, they didn't so much want to put out a blueprint for what socialism would look like, because right away, if you're raised under capitalism and you have a problem really imagining what the world could be like under democratic economic planning on a world scale, with all the resources freed up from profit mongering and profit making, freed up from exploitation of labor and nature by the rich capitalists, by the big corporations, and by the governments they control, which is a whole new world, right? So if you're in the old world and you're trying to describe the new world, it's a little hard. But one thing, a few kind of trends, overall possibilities and probabilities could be discussed, if not a blueprint. A lot of people want a blueprint. What's a social society going to look like? Well, it's going to look a lot different than this one, and it's going to be hard to explain all the details, because people have to create those details. You know, people think they're empowered here as individuals. Real individualism, real power for every person comes only in a social society where there are enough resources to go around so everybody is equal. That doesn't mean everyone has exactly the same amount of stuff and everyone is, you know, that. It's that basically everyone has a decent life, what they need, and more than what they need, actually. And then from there, using part of those resources to decide. It would become very important in a social society to say, this much for work, this much for decision making. You know, this much to share out the work, this much to share out what we're going to do with the work and the results of the work. What's that going to go for? And if you think people are going to just vote for and work for making rich people richer, which is going to, people are going to look back, if we achieve social, they're going to look back at the society and say, were we fools or what? Because we voted for people in our limited, very limited, 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 limited democracies, quote unquote, for people whose sole purpose was to defend the system of capitalism and to make rich people richer. And that's going to segue into the next thing we're going to talk about, hopefully. But that is that's going to look like craziness. It's going to look like insanity. And that coupled with the destruction of the environment and so on, to the needless deaths from starvation and undernourishment and disease in a world of where the technologies and amount of food exist that everyone could have a decent life, that's going to be hard to explain to people in the future. Just like there are people now, as more and more is being discovered and talked about or forced to talk about in terms of slavery in the United States, for example, but it should be other places too, and it is actually, if you look into it, the legacies of slavery, long overdue information, long overdue calls for reparation and discussions around reparations and what that would look like, and if reparations for reparations due a lot of people under capitalism, and of course, capitalism being based on the slave labor in the U.S. Based on the throwing Native Americans off the land that they were that was part of their territory, really, in the sense of how they lived, and you know, I'm being careful with terms I use, because for Native Americans owning the land, and this should be true of us as well, and I'm not talking about little households and stuff, I'm talking about massive land ownership, for people to say I, John Rockefeller, or I, Bill Gates, own millions of acres, that's sociopathy. That's just insane. That's killing us, you know? No, you don't. You don't own the planet. You don't. You don't own the earth. You don't own natural resources. These are collective. These are owned by humanity. Not owned is even the wrong word. These are things that humanity needs to survive. We better figure out how to use them and replace them, you know, in a just way and in a sustainable way. That's not going to happen under capitalism. We keep threatening to have a show on eco-socialism alone, where, you know, part of the socialist movement is, I would say, eco-socialism. I don't separate it out. Where, because, you know, Marx even and Engels and others that started the socialist movement way, way back in the 1800s, they were talking about, if you dig into their readings, into their writings, sorry, if you dig into their writings, they were talking about the exploitation of nature under capitalism, brutal, brutal exploitation of nature under capitalism, and how that is not sustainable, how that can't go forever, and how that would have to be democratically controlled and managed and done in a very different ways, production in very different ways, and waste management done in very different ways. Those are in some ways old ideas, but there's new technologies and new angles on that, and always new education to be done. Which brings me back to my original point. We're going to talk a little bit about where millennials are at in terms of the economy and the dangers of the next recession to certain sections of the working class, heightened dangers to the certain sections of the working class, to dangers that exist for everyone under capitalism at any time, boom or bust. But the point is that there's a lot of factors that are constantly at work under capitalism, but that at certain times they're more clear than others. But the very fact that rich people and the big corporations are exploiting people, and that the country's rigged for the wealthy, for the rich, and they're only wealthy from our labor, by the way, from labor of working people. A lot of people know that. So you could say that, yeah, and there's people out there that consider themselves socialists or that really are socialists, and they could say to me, "What, you know, why are you bothering? Why are you just repeating this stuff? You know, well, first of all, we're not repeating stuff. There's a lot of new stuff coming in and we're talking about it and so on. But why are you repeating some of the same themes? Why do I need facts about millennials? I know everybody's screwed under capitalism. Well, you need them so you can use them to organize. Because it doesn't do us any good if you just whine about it. It doesn't do us any good if you just say, "Ah, everyone's screwed under capitalism. It's a rotten system. I have this knowledge now that not everybody has. Well, try to make sure everybody has, or a lot of people have it. Try to help organize. Try to help educate, agitate, organize, you know, as they say. Again, going back to the roots of this show, it was never a show to be one of those kind of liberal. Well, first of all, we're not liberals, and we really don't like liberalism. We really don't. Socialists are way to the left of liberalism if they're real socialists. A real Marxist, a real socialist does not support capitalism, does not support capitalist political parties, and is looking for a social revolution, a transformation from capitalism to socialism, to democratic socialism. There are many people that call themselves socialists that don't believe in any of that stuff. They want to reform capitalism. They want to reform the Democratic Party or something, other party or something in other countries. And they want to, that's controlled by big corporations. And they want to, you know, they don't think you need a revolution ultimately. They don't think you need a revolutionary transformation ultimately of the economy. Well, we part ways there on those three fundamentals. Here in the United States, it gets really crazy. You have people talk about the left as the Democratic Party. I hear that every day, practically, on the corporate media. And I hear it from people that should know better, that claim they're Marxists or socialists. And right when you say it, when that comes out of your mouth, boom, you've lost your socialist credentials. Sorry. Of course, we can still have the discussion, and you can still pretend you're a socialist, and whatever. You know, it's not, that's not the, you know, we're not going to change things simply based on ideas. We're going to change it based on organizing. But hey, that's a problem then, because a lot of times the ideas that people have, most times we'll say, that indicates what kind of organizing they're going to do. So if they think they can reform the Democratic Party, they spend more and more time orientating to the inner machinations, the Machiavellian machinations within the Democratic Party, such as it exists, such as they can have any influence at all. They always overstate their influence, of course. And they talk about reforming the Democratic Party and supporting this or that Democrat, or they do things that the liberals think are okay, but the other stuff, you know, down and dirty union organizing, taking on the real wealth of society, big corporations, including nonprofits and so on, they back off. They don't criticize the Democrats that much, the left Democrats, if they're so-called, you know, left Democrats. I don't believe in the term left Democrats. I believe in left. You can call a Democrat left populist, call Democrat, some Democrats progressive. Like, I would call Sanders, he's a progressive Democrat. He's a left populist Democrat. Does that make him any more worthy of our support, of our vote? Personally, I say no. Personally, I say no. Not at all. If Sanders tomorrow goes independent and takes that independent role to as part of a movement to build a workers' party of some sort for working people that won't take corporate donations, that isn't controlled by the corporations, not just by money, but ideology as well, then I say, yeah, I support Sanders, but not can't support Sanders if he's running as a Democrat, because there's a million and one ways he's tied to the Democratic Party, and then he's helping the Democratic Party with his failed mission to, quote unquote, reform the Democratic Party. So that's my personal opinion. What I wanted to get into here is this. We're going to throw out facts on the show. We have what we do all the time that you might feel you already know. I know it's going to be bad in the next recession for us, but we're throwing out the facts so you can use them at work. You can use them in your school. You can use them in your family. You can use them in your neighborhood to organize, to make points, but not for, you know, political discussion around the Thanksgiving table to win that one. That's not an important one to win, by the way. You're not going to win it. What you got to do in a lot of political discussions, in my opinion, and I think, and I've organized a lot of people into unions and organized a lot of people into socialist groups, if you want to use a broad definition. And, The way I've done that somewhat successfully, no one's, I've certainly had my failures in this, but somewhat successfully, is because sometimes you got to understand you're planting a seed when you talk to somebody. You're not going to win that initial discussion. They might even get mad at you. they might not even not like you. And God forbid, in America, not, so you're not liked, because everyone wants to be liked so bad. I want to be liked. I want to be popular. Blah blah. I mean, that's just where we're raised that way. In case, you know, if you're from another country and you're listening in, it's like, hey, you know why Americans smile so much and laugh and talk loud? We really want to be liked. We're desperate for that. And still, we're in the most alienated country, alien society, based on capitalism, by the way, in the world. I would argue. Maybe there's worse. Maybe there's more alienated places. But anyway, so I was going to make a joke about that, about someone I know from another country that certainly is alienated, but they live here. So the point is that you're not looking to win every argument. Sometimes you can. Sometimes you can see right in front of you someone you're talking to, right next to you. They're actually listening, and they're actually, you know, kind of interested in what you're saying. They haven't quite heard it before. And you live for those moments, right? But you also live for the moment where you have been working away, working away, working away, thinking you're not getting anywhere, but people have been listening. But more importantly, people have been watching. What do you do? That's extremely important. That's what the people that are trying to reform the Democratic Party or buy into that don't understand, right? You can criticize the Democratic Party, but think you're very successful, very, very clever by supporting certain Democratic candidates at the same time you're criticizing the Democratic Party. But you're not clever at all, because you're pointing people towards the Democratic Party. That's the main thing people are going to understand from what you're talking about, is either you talk out of both sides of your face, right? Both sides of your mouth, or whatever that cliche is. Or you're saying, hey, you vote for this Democrat, it's going to move things forward. And if you vote for the Democrat, you're voting for the Democratic Party, because the candidates of the Democratic Party are what makes up the Democratic Party. It's not really, it's not a membership-based party. And even if it was, this would still hold true to a certain extent. The only way the party moves at all, right, the Democratic Party, is through the elections. And it moves within certain parameters based on where it gets its money from, where its history, its ideology, it's pro-capitalist, capitalist, straight up, capitalists in the party running it, in the Democratic Party running it, in terms of its inner workings in the DNC. That none of that stuff is open to the public. None of that stuff's elected. In terms of so-called reforming the Democratic Party, which from the left we're talking about, has never worked. It will never work. There could be people not voting for the Democratic Party in the future. There could be people, quote unquote, splitting from the Democratic Party, although that's kind of a false term because there's no membership. But let's say they decide to vote some other way, which they do now. There's people that vote Republican in one election, which is not helping them, working people. People that vote Democrat in the next election, not helping them either. Not seeing any other alternative. They keep doing that ping pong vote, or they stop voting, which millions and millions do. And that's not good either. That doesn't help us either. What we need is an alternative. For working people, for the mass of people, we need a political alternative. And until you start building that political alternative, and maybe it comes out of certain regions, certain cities at first, but until people start seeing that coalesce, they're going to feel like they have nowhere to go with their votes. And so that's another segue into what we're going to talk about in a minute with independent socialists that are out there now and in 2020, most likely. But again, whether it's that information or the information about the economy that you think you already know or whatever, well, keep up to date with your facts and figures, your citations, your sources. Be ready for those discussions when they appear. Make opportunities for discussions and organize people in an informed way. Remembering, you might not be liked for your opinion. You might not win the immediate argument, but you might just plant a seed, because then people's own experience will run them into what you're talking about, if you're talking about things that are generally true, right? If your perspectives are generally correct, then, and they see, say, a Democrat that has all the liberal populist left populist credentials, and then does something like supports U.S. imperialism, right? In other countries, supports wars or doesn't speak out against them or whatever. When you see them vote for bills like that trade bill that was like, that's, you know, the next generation of NAFTA, that doesn't help working people, it actually hurts them really badly, then, you know, people figure that stuff out, you know, over time, or they give up on it, which is really bad, and you have to try to re-engage them again with that alternative, with something to re-engage with, a union. Hopefully a progressive one, and not the kind that sells you out. and you have to take that risk. It's better to have a bad union than no union, believe me. because a bad union, there's a chance of reforming, or there's a chance of outside things hitting it and happen and influencing it in a good way, even if you can't reform it immediately, or get people interested and engaged with the political alternative to the Democrats and Republicans that's yet to be built. But even in its infancy, even as it's being built, people can tune into that and see that there is somewhere to go. There is some hope forward politically, other than the same old corporate-sponsored, we bring you the duopoly, the Republicans and the Democrats, the Republicrats, the Demrepubs. That doesn't mean to say the two parties are the same. I mean, you can see a big gulf on issues, certain issues on the surface between Trump and the Democratic Party, the Trump Republicans and the, you know, a lot of the Democrats. But you can also see, unfortunately, a lot of bipartisan agreement and a lot of things that they, especially below the surface, have in common. For example, Nancy Pelosi saying, hey, we're all capitalists. That's just the way it is. Well, Trump is a capitalist, right? You support capitalism, you support Trump. Chew on that, liberals. Chew on that, liberals. You support capitalism, you support Trump, right? I heard a national propaganda radio show today. They were interviewing people in New Hampshire, and the whole thing was skewed as sort of a secret sort of anti-Sanders thing. And again, I'm not saying that to defend Sanders. Sanders running as a Democrat, to me, that makes Sanders part of the corporate political spectrum. But you could tell that everything in this show very subtly was anti-Sanders. And this report on this New Hampshire Democratic Party thing, which you had to buy tickets for, by the way. I wonder how much they were. So anyway, wow, what is that noise? Oh, I know what that noise is. Never mind. Hope you're not hearing the noise of the fan that's cooling down a machine here. But anyway, this show was totally skewed against Sanders in a way that just stressed, you know, what some people call centrism. That's not the quite correct use of the term, but meaning supporting a candidate that they think will beat Trump, that they assume Americans are such and such politically, that they'll be scared by certain demands that Sanders talks about, certain issues that Sanders talks about. You know, is Warren safe enough? That kind of talk, you know, which is every election. I've heard this for many decades, many years. And so they come up with, you know, now for me, a candidate, whether it's from the so-called liberal left spectrum of the Democrats or the more conservative spectrum of Democrats, they're all safe for the system. But there are disagreements within the Democratic Party of which one is the most electable based on certain election criteria. And that's, you know, what they're fighting about mostly. It's just about who's going to win and get the spoils of office and power. And then you watch. It happens every time. They're not going to go through, and they're not going to overturn all the damage Trump has done. Every time you get a Democrat elected or a Republican elected after damage has been done by the previous candidate, they never overturn it all. They basically run with it. You know, neoliberalism started, if you look carefully, under Carter, and none of the regimes in there since, including Obama, have blinked an eye. Have turned against it. They've all accepted neoliberalism, embraced it in slightly different ways here and there, and put it forward. And that will happen with whoever the Democrats put up. It's guaranteed. It's a guarantee. So a lot of the things that Trump has done have helped neoliberalism. Now, but neoliberalism is a fancy term for capitalism with less regulation and less social benefits than existed in the post-war upswing, where the strength of movements from the 30s and 40s, the labor movement and the left and so on, the real left, had forced capitalism on the defensive somewhat. World War II, World War I, World War II, and the destruction and the political upheavals out of that had a lot to do with that. Once starting in the mid-70s, or really the early 70s, when the economy in the United States, when the